Welcome to In Development, the podcast where we dig into the real technical work behind building games and interactive worlds. I'm your host, Jace Lindgren, and this episode is something a little bit different. We recorded this one live at the GDC Festival of Gaming in San Francisco, where I got to sit down with Tom Gearman, the co-founder and CTO of Sandfall Interactive, the studio behind Clair Obscur, Expedition 33, winner of the Game of the Year, as well as a host of other awards. Tom talks openly about what it took to go from a one-person passion project to a small three-person team to eventually a 30-person studio plus contractors as they pushed toward launch. He gets into the real growing pains, how their production pipeline had to evolve as the team scaled, as publisher expectations began to kick in, and as the pressure mounted to actually ship the game. What I love about this conversation is the honesty. This is a team that got it done with a mix of professional tools that are industry tested, as well as their own scrappy self-written scripts and automations. And the result was a game that became a global sensation. So with that, let's dive into the interview.
So thank you so much for joining me today, Tom.
Yeah, super happy to be here. Really happy to be doing this. Yeah.
I'm sure I don't have to introduce to anyone here what Clair Obscur Expedition 33 is, but just in case you haven't seen it, we'll play a little trailer of that game, which is up for basically every award there is in gaming right now.
The conversations we'll never have, the time we'll never spend.
We exist for as long as she wants.
The Paintress, Renoir, they will pay.
Break the cycle! It will only destroy the last tie you have to each other.
There's so many questions left to answer.
Look around. He just wants you to fly. Time for the greatest expedition in history. Let's celebrate.
Let's celebrate.
Yeah, so many compliments in that trailer. Like, it's overwhelming.
Yeah. So for many of you out there, you probably know this already, but Expedition 33, this team that you put together for Sandfall was just three of you at first, right?
I mean, at the very beginning, it was like only Guillaume, you know, the creative director. So he started that project in his bedroom, literally. And yeah, I think that's something I said before, but it's literally, you know, the same project files that just, you know, kept growing and growing until we created the studio and we had the vertical slice. And what we actually shipped is really the same project file as what, you know, Guillaume started in his bedroom in 2019 when we were both in Sweden, working at Massive on the Division 2. So we were colleagues and friends at the time. So yeah, it's a bit crazy to see, you know, how far this project went in the end.
Yeah. And what I love about this is that whenever I'm talking to people who are starting a new indie studio, right, like they have some idea, they're working with a couple friends or something, and they want to do something, there can be this feeling of like, yeah, but we just don't know enough. We don't know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And you all had backgrounds at bigger, you know, AAA game studios. But then when you and I were talking about this, you're like, yeah, but when you're in those big studios, you have your specialty, you have your area. Yeah. But you don't know all the other stuff necessarily. And you're like, I know that there should be something here. Like, I know someone should be doing this. Yeah. And so in one of those for you was Perforce, was getting that set up right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, that's so coming from Ubisoft, they were using Perforce, of course. But yeah, when you start, you know, the project and you have, you know, so it was Guillaume and myself at first, and then we had Nicolas, you know, the art director. He started working on the project as well, contributing a little bit on new levels, that kind of things. And we started to see that we couldn't just, you know, with Guillaume before that, we would be exchanging files back and forth through, you know, Facebook Messenger or or by email or USB drives. So yeah, we had to, you know, step up a little bit. We couldn't use fucking Dropbox or Google Drive to exchange files. So that's when we started looking into which, you know, technical solutions we could use to have this first scale up phase, even though it wasn't much.
Like scaling up from two to three. Okay.
2 to 3 was already like a first, something that we had to think about a little bit. So at the time we turned to Perforce because like it was, you know, well integrated with Unreal, which was like a key point for us because we didn't want to spend time, you know, developing versioning tools or that kind of things. And with Unreal, you have Unreal Game Sync, which allows you to, you know, synchronize the latest files of the project and the latest binary of the editor.
So you used that right from the beginning. You had Unreal
almost,
Game Sync
like,
set up.
Like, okay. We set up Perforce at first just to exchange files. And then when we actually created the studios, so like 9 months after that, and some people in the team were coming in, we needed to have a way to share the editor binary files with everybody because we couldn't have everybody, you know, set up Visual Studio to compile the editor themselves because you would have, you know, a lot of issues doing that. So
building Unreal from source is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, exactly. Like you have different compiler versions and right. So we wanted something really like easy to use and bulletproof. And we were happy to discover that, you know, it was part of the Unreal ecosystem. It's not really, you know, at the time it wasn't marketed much. All those external tools that you do have to compile them yourself in the first place, but in the end, it's really like helping out, you know, the team to have like on a day-to-day basis, it's much easier for them to work if they don't have weird compilation errors when they are not programmers.
Yeah, for sure. And that's actually a lot easier now. I feel like when you were doing that, Unreal Game Sync still took a lot more manual compiling, and now actually Epic's made that a lot easier with Horde. You can just install that and then download UGS and it's all there, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is something we are looking, you know, for the next project, we can upgrade that, because a lot of the tools that we had, of course, they were set up in 2020, 2021.
And you've just kept them like that.
And so, and you know, when it works, sometimes you don't have to touch it. There are many tools that are available, and when it comes to versioning, when it comes to DevOps, which is also like a big topic that you have to deal with, you know, when the team is like growing and the scope of the project is growing and you start to have, you know, milestones, and you have to have a reliable build system to put out the builds for either, I don't know, the vertical slice, or when you sign a publisher, you have publisher milestones that you have to be consistently delivering.
Right.
So yeah, and even just for, you know, day-to-day QA, having a nightly build that you don't have to, you know, manually trigger on your own machine, or it's like coming, it's going a long way to professionalizing the environment in which the team is working. And QA team has new fresh builds every day, or if there is an issue, you see it like on a day-to-day basis, which is much better than month-to-month basis, which we were doing before.
Yeah, for sure. And so to kind of frame what we're going to be talking about today, so the title of this talk that we submitted was this Scaling Up a Project with the Creators of Clair Obscur Expedition 33. What I wanted to call it was A Tale of Three Bots, A Brief History of Sandfall Interactive, and Audiovisual Play in Three Acts. But that one didn't get accepted for some reason. I don't know what the deal is with that. But kind of when we were talking about this, we talked about how, you know, you were this very small team, very scrappy, trying to put this together. You didn't have like a whole team to manage your build pipeline for you. You all had to do this yourselves. And in doing that, you talked about there were these three bots that you kind of built along the way, or three like automations that you built for yourselves along the way. And so I think that might be a fun way to kind of line up where we are in the story with how many bots we have. So at what point did you make that first one that was about getting awareness? So like, tell us about that. Here we go. Act one.
Act one. Very dramatic. First of all, like when we create a bot, you know, like it's of course developer time, and developer time is super precious at Sandfall. And for a while, I was the only programmer in the team.
So you were doing all this automation stuff yourself?
At the very beginning, I would. So, and the time I would spend doing that would be time not spent on, you know, developing the battle system, fixing bugs, helping people with, you know, crashes in the editor, those kind of things. So when we decide to develop a tool like that, we really consider how important it is that we actually have this. It's not like, oh, let's just try and see how it goes. Like we, yeah, it's a... an actual decision that we have to make. So the very first tool came in as we opened up the studio in Montpellier. So we had
so how many people?
So at the time it was like 6 people on site and 1 person remote.
Okay, got it.
So yeah, we just had, you know, fundraising money to open up an actual studio and hire people.
Okay.
So the team started to grow a little bit at this point, and that means more content was, you know, being pushed on Perforce, and we had François, so another co-founder of Sandful, who was doing the producing of the project, and he needed, you know, to have visibility over what people were doing in the project, because it was all very organic. It's a small team, so, you know, the game director can go and discuss with everybody. Everybody's talking to each other directly over the desk, and François was also working part-time remote from Paris, so we were based in Montpellier, southern France, but he was based with his family in Paris. So he would come very often to Montpellier, but still, like, a lot was happening, you know, in the room when it comes to what is being developed by the team. So yeah, he needed better visibility of what was going on. So the first bot that we developed was an integration with Discord, actually. So every new submit that would be pushed on Perforce would trigger like a quick message with changes number, description, who pushed it, which branch, on a dedicated channel in Discord. And this way, even when you don't have, you know, P4V installed or from Paris, you wouldn't have access to the, you know, internal,
like on your phone,
the local server, like right. From your phone as well. It can be useful sometimes as well when Guillaume was doing, you know, some late nights,
right.
Which would, you know, keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
So it was really helpful to share this visibility of what's going on in the project. And quickly later, we had a producer intern coming in as well. So he was based in Montpellier, but still the tool for him was super convenient for him to check what was happening on the project. And when he saw something happening, he could, you know, go talk to the person. It would, you know, be a conversation starter, basically.
Right. Yeah. See that, like, you knew that you needed to be more aware of what was going on.
Yeah. As you grow, like, it's not always possible, you know, to keep an eye on everything. So having a simple way to check that, it's really, and you have, you know, it's maybe a bit stupid, but you have, you know, the new message notification. So, you know, when you're up to date or when there's been new stuff.
I see.
On that channel,
you can kind of see how many new messages there were.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, got it. Nice.
You can see it's been a busy night for Guillaume or not.
Right. And so you use Discord through the whole process, right? Just with your little bots and automations and things like that?
Yeah, Discord, it's really like our central tool for communication. And as we moved further on the project, like we have, you know, excellent partners on specific channels as well. So when it comes to QA, for example, we have dedicated channels to communicate with them. So it's really like very central to the way we work. We did some efforts, you know, to, even when some people are in the same room, to still put a message in there so people that are not on site can still, you know, see what's going on or catch up
commentary
later.
And catch up on
exactly,
it. Okay, So what I like about that, and I feel like the thing I really took away, was this idea that you don't need to pay for every single tool or like everything to do it for you. If you're just like, I'll take an afternoon and I'll make a little automation here.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as the things you're using let you do that, right? Like they have an API, they have some way that you can get in there and make your own things. So you sent over a few videos of some earlier versions of the game. And some of you out there have maybe seen some of these before. I want to show this first one that you sent, and then tell us a little bit about like where this was in the timeline of everything.
Okay. How did it turn to this?
Did you kill them all?
To this question, I have no answer. As I clean my blade from the blood of the innocent, I wonder, is there no one left to save? Now it all ends, turning our back to humanity as we condemn it. This was our story. The story of how we fought, and the story of how we lost.
End of the line.
Coming out soon for PlayStation 3.
Yeah,
I think. Yeah,
please pre-order.
So how big was the team at the point that you made this?
So at this point, it was really like, I would say 1.5. It was mostly Guillaume.
So this was super
with
early.
With some, you know, technical support for me. So it's like, I think late 2019, maybe early 2020 at most.
Wow.
But yeah, there's quite a lot to unpack in here. But the funny thing is that most of the characters you see here are actually, you know, you already have Verso, you already have Male, the faceless girl. You have Lune, you have Ciel, who was called Sif at the time.
Mm, okay.
Like, it's funny to see, you know, some parts that stay the same over the course of production. But yet, yeah, it's so different. And when it comes to the art style, it's, you know, all over the place because it was just Guillaume going on the Unreal Marketplace and finding, you know, the free assets of the month. And So that's why you have, you know, sci-fi, where you have dragons and...
I wondered about that. Yeah, where the sci-fi went. It kind of disappeared at some point.
I mean, for the best, maybe, when it comes to our game. So, but the interesting thing also is that you can see the foundation of the battle system. Which was already there, and when it comes to...
So kind of the timing-based battling, I kind of saw that with the meter filling up.
Yeah, the QT, like the dodging was QT-based at the time with that UI that you can see.
Right.
But yeah, yet you already have the foundation of what is Expedition 33 in the end, but just at a much different, you know, scale in terms of both scope and art style as well. But I think this video is a good testament of the, you know, development philosophy at Sunfall, because this is almost the work of one person using all the tools at their disposal. You can see that there are, you know, some facial animation, there are some cinematics, like in a way, with some text-to-speech. So it's really like made with everything that was available to you. And the free assets are a big part of that. And we kind of kept this idea of, you know, punching above our weight. Even when the team grew, when we had, you know, artists joining in, the team, like, having a game that would look as if it was made by more people than it actually is. I mean, it's not the end goal, of course, but it's just like we love to, you know, push the tools to their limits, and we just kept doing that. Even, and it's still the case now that the team is around 30 people big. So
30, you said?
Yeah, right now it's like a 28 for, to be accurate.
Yeah, and I think that to me is mind-blowing with like what a big deal Expedition 33 has been and like how many accolades that it's still like this quite small team that you have. Like,
yeah,
this very...
I mean, at the core of development team, it's quite small. I think at peak of production, if you include the Korean animators that are technically, you know, freelance, but it's like animation is such an important part of the creative work that... Yeah, they're in our hearts, they are part of the team.
Right.
So yeah, the creative team and programming team, at peak it would be like 40 people. And then you have, of course, you know, QA, porting, localization. So it adds up a lot, in particular localization. We have so many languages, you know, supported and more coming that it's a lot of extra people that join later in the project. But yeah, the core team was, this size at the peak, but it was really like a journey, you know, of scaling up from, you know, just Guillaume and me a little bit at the beginning, and six. Then we did the vertical slice with 12 people. So we worked on that for a bit less than a year. And we came to GDC 2022 with that demo on a super beefy laptop to showcase it in, you know, like, we were on the show floor, actually, like there was like a business friends booth present there. And we also did tons of meetings in hotel lobbies. So we would bring the laptop, showcase the demo. It was supposed to be, you know, only 20 minutes long, because that's the most attention you will get, you know, from publisher at this stage of the project. But our demo, I think overall, was maybe 2 hours long if you wanted to see everything.
Wow.
So we were basically speedrunning the demo for publishers so they could have an idea of what the game was. And that's when we actually signed with Kepler Interactive. I mean, we met with them first, and then we had more meetings to make sure that we liked each other.
Right.
And then the team grew much bigger after we signed with them, because it meant we had, you know, more funding to keep working on the project with a bigger team for longer as well. Because when you start out, you have, you know, limited money, so limited team size and development time as well.
So during this time, you said you went up to like 12-ish people?
Yeah, for the vertical slice.
Okay.
Yeah. And then that's when we started to scale up after...
I see.
Yeah,
after
unlocking the publisher achievement.
right.
It was like around 22 people in the year that for 24. And that's when the programming team also started to expand a little bit, which was good for me because it was a bit hard to, you know, keep track of everything that was going on a team of 12 as a single programmer, because you have, you know, more people in the team. That means more crashes of the editor to investigate, more just issues, more features, feature requests as well. So you kind of have to, you know, keep an eye on all that and still be developing features, because we still needed you know, the battle system to improve, because as you can see, there was quite a lot to improve from the first versions.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it'd be interesting to do a whole talk just like going through that video and looking at what things stayed around, because like there's some effects I see in there where I'm like, oh yeah, that kind of like ink drop effect, I'm like, that's still in the game, or like that kind of like the warping of the environment around hits and things. I'm like, okay, still in the game,
in
right?
The
like,
art direction.
Like the art decisions that were made early kind of stuck, and then which ones completely didn't, like the, you know, sci-fi tablet for doing magic or whatever.
Dragons.
Yeah, dragons, that too. So we're talking about kind of growing a little bit. So we're in act two now, the rising action. And this is where you're now starting to ramp up. And so you were doing these demos, or you did these demos at GDC and ended up, you know, finding someone to work with Kepler Interactive. Did you find that in that process, before we get into the next bot, before we meet our next hero, is when you were doing that process, did you find that things went wrong a lot in those demos? Or was it like you spent so much time getting it rock solid before you showed it to anybody? I'm always curious, like, when do you say it's good enough? Because you could do it forever, right? Yeah. Like, where do you draw the line?
I mean, GDC was basically our deadline for the vertical slice, because of course you can always, you know, improve and refine. But for us, the goal was to really showcase the different aspects of the project. So the vertical slice will start off with a cinematic, because of course, as you know, it's super important in the final game, and to see, you know, the dynamic between the characters. Then we would have tutorial fights because mm-hmm. it's an RPG with, you know, a lot of moving parts for the yeah. players. So when we would be sending, you know, the build out for publishers to try out, you still need to tutorialize a little bit because you just like, I mean, you still can, you know, give the build with a PDF file sitting next to it. But yeah, having proper tutorials, I think it really helps, you know, staying in the immersion and in the mood of the game.
That's really interesting to me, because I feel like we see a lot of games now that will like be released widely in early access and still don't have tutorials in it.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to figure it out. So that makes a lot of sense to prioritize the player experience, because that's also your investor's experience yeah. of looking at this. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like the Picto system and the Lumina system, even today in the final game with the tutorials and we did our best for the UX, but still, so sorry about that. We still see people finishing the game, you know, without activating Lumina's on Reddit.
Really? Wow. Anyway,
we see those kind of threads. So so yeah, it was important for us to yeah provide as much as possible so people could genuinely enjoy the game if they decided to, you know, spend more time playing it. So yeah, but it was mostly a matter of the deadline. We knew we were going to San Francisco.
Okay,
to GDC.
You set that for
yeah.
yourselves.
Oh yeah, we had like so many meetings, you know, planned in advance. So there was like no going back, you know.
Nice.
So so yeah.
So introduce us to the second bot that you ended up creating here.
So yeah, after we signed with Kepler, so there was much more happening in the project as the team grew bigger and we started having publisher milestones. So at those moments, you need to ensure stability much more when you are closing into that milestone. We started working also more with, you know, different branches where you have part of the team stabilizing what will be, you know, shipped for the milestone. And the more creative part of the team can, you know, start working on the next content for the rest of the game. And you don't want, you know, those two different type of work to interfere with each other. So we had separate branches, and on the release branch, we would have a new bot that would basically be submit change list validation. So people
okay, like what kind of validation?
So it would be like an approval based. So like if I want to push a change in that branch, I would do it. Like I would right click, submit. It would fail with an error message telling me, okay, you need to get approval for that change list because we are at this, you know, sensitive part stage of the project. And it would automatically push a Discord message to another channel, which was dedicated to that. And then we would have, so this is a Perforce bot, a Discord bot. Running in the background. So we would have a message with, you know, the change list description and approve or refuse decline button.
Just like the buttons would show up right in Discord.
Oh yeah, directly in Discord. Okay. So the idea was, yeah, to have that as convenient as possible, because when you are adding, you know, friction to submitting new changes to the code base, you want yet people to not wait, you know, 1 day, 2 days before they can actually submit their changes, because we are working mostly with, you know, blueprints or just assets files that are binary. So you have exclusive locks, so you cannot have two people working on the same file at the same time. So it's very important to not lock files for too long when we are in this phase.
And so that's why you were trying to get those approvals through quickly.
Yeah,
exactly. So that it's like alert someone on Discord so they can just respond right away, yeah. Make it easy. Okay, yeah.
You know, the notification also, okay, there is a new approval request pending. You have to look into it. And also with Discord, you can easily, you know, manage permission groups as well. So we would have basically this tool really well integrated with our Discord roles.
Okay, yeah. So, like,
so not everybody could, you know,
it.
Self-approve. Yeah, yeah, this is good too.
Yeah, my changes are perfect. Nothing
as
breaks. Yeah, nice. So I have, I think here, one more video from a little bit later in the process, I believe.
This was, yeah, still a bit
still
before.
A bit earlier, okay.
I have yet to see... Okay, so this is still an early demo.
Okay.
We made that after the one we saw earlier, but it was during the fundraising. The initial seed fundraising process, we basically made three demos for that. So the big one that you showed earlier, this one where we had like a more maybe specific art style with this steampunk
Right, this looks more like the game to me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's obviously still very different.
Yeah.
He's close.
Stay focused, Maya.
So this is Verso. I'm going ahead. And Ciel, old version. And Mael flying around.
Oh, good. She's floating.
But the funny thing is that, like, in that demo, Mael's mechanic ended up being Ciel's mechanic.
Right, right. The thing that also struck me about these videos is how Verso sounds so American.
Oh, yeah. Like
it's like instead a of the actual Texas speech. Game. Like, yeah. Is that that's what it is?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like, okay. You know, you go online, it's just like the basic ones.
That's funny, yeah.
But the music was already from our current composer, Lorient.
Okay, so he actually...
Yeah, he joined super early in the project, and I think that's how he managed, you know, to put out so much music in the original soundtrack.
Wow. So that's really interesting. I want to talk about that a little bit. So with your team, in terms of the makeup of it, I feel like a lot of teams will kind of start with some basic prototype and then they'll keep developing their game and kind of go, yeah, later I'll get some artists in and like later I'll get sound design and voices and all of that. But for you, like saying that the composer was actually a really early part of that process.
Yeah.
I don't hear that very often unless it's like a game that is a musical or something like right? And I think that really comes through in the finished project, that there is this like the music is not an afterthought.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the reason why everyone's, you know, jamming out to the songs from Clair Obscur all over the place, like live shows, you know, all of that. Because that, I guess, like had a lot of time to develop and to get refined.
Yeah.
And
yeah, because like this particular demo is 2020. Uh-huh. So by that time, we had already the art director and the composer on board. Which is like so important for, you know, defining what the game will be in terms of the art parts.
Right.
We kind of had, you know, the battle system figured out. Guillaume was very clear in what he wanted to do in terms of game design also. But yeah, this is 2020. So it really gave the time to, you know, develop the ID and then go back to something different. At that time, we didn't have the concept of the expeditions and the monolith. It wasn't present then. It came in later with the art style also with, you know, the expeditioner outfits. For a while, they had red capes. In the end, we went with, you know, this black and gold style, which is very distinct, I think. And the music you hear in this demo is actually pretty close to the intro music in Lumiere at the very beginning.
Okay, I was going to say, it like, sounds very
the
familiar.
Guitar and,
and that's so wild that was 5 years earlier that music was already and, part of the game.
We did like another demo after that, and it also had original music in it. And it's also like a song that got, of course, re-recorded over time. But it was like, you can hear it in the final game.
Nice.
So, almost 6 years later, it's pretty crazy. I think that's what makes it so good to not have, you know, sometimes in game development, you have gray boxes for super long in the process. And the way we work with an environment at Sunfold, sometimes it's quite different. Sometimes we start from actual level design, so gray boxes, but sometimes we do it the other way around, where we have the art director going into the scene and actually putting, you know, stuff that he thinks is cool, you know, and from there,
it's like, this is the look that I want.
This is the feeling I want. Or it could be so cool to have, you know, like a crashed tree like this, and from there you have level design opportunities that you can build on top of that.
Right.
So I think the core idea that we really went with the flow,
correct,
during this whole project, and that's what gives it its authenticity, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So now tell us about the final boss here. The third bot that you had to make, kind of as you're actually approaching deadlines of not just we need this for investors, but like, We have a release date. We have to ship this thing.
You spend many years working on the project. You have like thousands and thousands of files, and you need to actually ship it, right? So when this stage comes in, it's like much, how do you say that? It's the stakes are much higher than publisher milestones, because we got along super well with our publisher. So if we needed sometimes an extra couple of weeks to finish the milestone, it would be fine to postpone. when you have settled a release date and you have trailers announcing that to players, it's, yeah, you can't really, yeah,
right.
shift that without, yeah, having the marketing team being like, oh no.
Yeah, yeah.
So as you move closer to release, stability becomes more and more important. And you are also starting to work with many more branches than what we were doing earlier, because you have the game that will ship to the players, so with the famous day one patch. But before that, you also have press demos right. that are, like, we did that with the first two levels of the game. So we had Lumiere and Spring Meadows being playable to like some streamers or some influencers as well.
Beforehand, right.
So
right.
it's a specific version of the game that was specifically made just for that. And it's like a couple months before release. So you are both busy stabilizing this very specific part of the game that people will experience earlier. But you are also working on your day one patch, because you still have, you know, approval processes on the major platforms. So it's not like, yeah, 2 hours before launch, you, oh yeah, let's just do one more update
right.
to the game. So we are starting to work with, yeah, different branches. So the short demo, then you have a full demo going live a few weeks after that. And this is what is used by journalists for the Metascore, which is super
okay.
important.
I see. So that's decided like before it's even out.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
That makes sense.
In particular, as a small studio, like, people don't know the name of Sandfall. They don't know the IP beforehand, which makes sense.
Yeah.
So the Metascore is like so important for us because it's the first impression of the game are the trailers, of course. But maybe the second impression people get from the game are, yeah, the Metascore. And a lot of gamers, you know, they choose which games they're going to play or not based on that. So it was important for us to have like a press version of the game that was as good as possible and as stable as possible as well.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, many, many branches that are, yeah, happening in parallel. And when you are doing a fix for the day one patch, some of those fixes, you want them for the short press demo or maybe just for the longer press demo that you still have more time to stabilize. So you're starting to, you know, merge things back and forth, and it can get a little bit trippy. Like it's easy to trip during that process, because sometimes you are, you know, modifying several files in one change list, and then you put another
kind of like
change
break everything else.
So. Yeah, and you can break everything else if you are not integrating everything, all the dependencies that have been added before. So to help with that process, what we created was basically an integration bot in a way that would help with, you know, all those branches that we had in parallel. It would help automate the process of, okay, from this development branch, we will integrate to the day one patch and also to the press demo patch. But this particular change requires like a texture from a previous change that was not yet integrated in those branches. So you have this whole game of tracking what has changed and has not yet been integrated in the final branches of the game. And it can get like quite long. Sometimes we had chains of, you know, like 10 modifications, 10 different changes from different people that had to be in the final release branch.
I see, like one person worked on something that referenced another file, that referenced another
yeah.
that a third person had worked on, and then like
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. If you add, you know, the animation of a character in one change list and the character itself in another, if you only have the animation without the character, it cannot work.
Right,
So you need to pull that back in. So this is the last bot that we created that would basically help automate this process. And I mean, it's much more. The two first bots were closer to, you know, producing and project management. This one was more for, you know, technical dependencies to make sure the game would be as stable as possible on all the branches all at once. And it's still a challenge when you have, you know, still a small team trying to have several branches being stable in parallel. So yeah, this bot would basically explore all the changes, see what was required and not integrated, and it would automatically create intermediate change lists doing those, you know, integrations for us.
So like it was actually hooking into Unreal's like dependency graph to like look at what other files were affected and then see if those had been changed?
It was more based on the files present in the change list.
I see. So it just kind of tracks.
When you have several
like
files, you make sure that the full history of those files are integrated, and the history of a file is not just the file itself, it's the change list, the full change list in which it was modified. So
I see.
It's a bit technical. Okay. Maybe I should have done a graph to explain that visually, but yeah, you get the idea of, yeah, one file can be changed by several change lists, and you need a way to track that, basically.
Right. And so what's the sense of, like, how long did each of these bots take to make? Just to give people a sense of, like, if they're working on a project and they go, yeah, actually, that'd be helpful for me.
Overall, I think it was, like, pretty quick by our standard. I would say maybe 3 or 4 days we had, like, the thing fully running, and we knew it would
save
us.
For this integration bot.
Yeah.
Like, the most advanced of them was still just, like, 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Exactly. And I mean, like, we were, you know, under time constraint. So, like, it was really an active decision of, okay, we're going to shift away from bug fixing, from polishing the game, and we're going to make that bot to make sure that the game is as stable as possible. Because also an interesting thing maybe to mention is that we have, you know, nightly build, because building the game, like the full packaged game from the project file into what we distribute, it's a long process. On the best server we have, it's like a bit less than an hour, but on more regular machines that we also use to package the game, can be up to 3 hours. So, and we have, you know, so many platforms, Xbox, PC, PlayStation, and right. On PC you have Steam, you have the Epic Game Store, all those are different versions of the game. So at night you have this small army
of machines doing all the different builds.
Building stuff. So if you happen to have, and all the branches, of course, mm-hmm. also, so it's really like a exponential. And if you happen to, you know, have missed an integration because you are doing it manually, this whole nightly process, it's wasted for nothing, because sometimes you can just have the game, you know, crash on boot because you are missing an important file that was not integrated. And then you're like, yeah, well, let's wait tomorrow before QA can actually start checking the changes that were made. So yeah, it's really easy to have, you know, a bottleneck coming from a broken build. So in those kind of situation, the QA team would stay, you know, on the last valid build that was put out. But yeah, we had.
So you at least have something that you can keep QA.
They always have something, going. But yeah, in the closing days of a project like this, it's every day, like we are fixing so much bugs that it's really like. Yeah, a build from one day ago feels like
it's still current ancient. Enough. We've still got, yeah. Wow. Okay, so I want to bring us into what I'm calling the epilogue here, which is I have a few kind of random little questions for you. And then the first one, I actually decided to make a video for you about something I experienced in Expedition 33. Ready.
Parry it! I love like hearing her frustration. Parry it!
I heard that a lot.
Parry it!
So, tell us about what happened here.
So yeah, this one is on me. Because basically, very late in the development process, we knew very early that we wanted, you know, the characters to, you know, not chat but react to what was going on in the battle, because it gives, you know, so much life into it. So very late in the project, that was, I think, the last big, you know, work that I done on the battle system. There would be this system of, you know, there are events of everything that is happening in the battle, and the character can process that information and choose what we call a battle line. So
right, yeah. And I noticed it would change based on who was in the battle with them.
Yeah,
who like is, they would yeah, shout exactly. to someone else of like, "Watch out!" Yeah, you know, like be careful, my
or
whatever.
Or thanks for the boost, or right, this kind right. Of lines. So
but there was this random list.
Yeah, it's a random list, but there is also this selection algorithm, which is like a pretty straightforward, but still it's important to pick only one line at once and not have all the characters react at the same time on the same action. And yeah, it's one of the risks when you do a feature pretty late in the project, is that you have, you know, less time to, you know, perfectly tune it. And for that particular example, the parried line had like a, basically we have a weight for each line to control how often it will trigger. And we are also supposed to have a cooldown for some of those lines, which are, you know, much more recognizable. Some of them are just like barks or grunts. So you can have that much more often. But the parry line was like very distinctive and it was triggering so often. And at some point we kind of, you know, discussed about should we fix that or keep it in the game. And we've seen, you know, so many memes around it that it's part of the lore around the game now. So we are just like, you know, rolling.
Mael is obsessed with parrying. That's all she can talk about. Yeah.
It's part of the game now. We have to accept it.
It's part of the world. If there's a sequel, you got to put that back in there.
Yeah. But I mean, it's interesting also everything that happens after you release the game, because some of the fixes you have to make, because some of the balancing, sometimes we just, you know, make a mistake in some values somewhere and we have to tune that down a little bit. So, for example, Stendhal was like a good example of that. It was very broken at release. It's still broken, but a little bit less. And then you also start to see, you know, like the speedrunners, they get interested into the game. So
they're really trying to find all the stuff you missed.
Yeah, exactly. Like all those bugs, they can use it, you know, to have shorter run times.
Right.
So at this point, you're like pondering whether or not fixing a bug would negatively affect the speedrunning community, versus could like a regular player run into this very game-breaking issue naturally without trying to break the game. So it's very interesting, you know, topics and discussions that we have around. It's a bit meta in the end, because of course it's not the intended design to be able to break the game and take shortcuts or skip to the final cinematic.
Right. But now it's bigger than just you. It's,
yeah, exactly. Once you release it, it's not in your hands anymore, literally.
Nice. A couple of questions I want to ask you real quick that will hopefully be helpful for other people. So the first one is, if you could travel back in time to yourself at the beginning of this process in 2019, is there any advice you would give to yourself then?
Yeah, I think when you begin a project like this and you are building up the studio and there aren't that many people, you know, in the team. And I mean, I was coming from Ubisoft where you have, you know, so many expert and senior people around you. So you know that whenever you are stuck, you are never really stuck because there are people around you to help you. When you start on a project like this, sometimes you can feel a little bit, you know, alone against a mountain of problems. But I think it's important to, you know, not lose hope that you will always, you know, find a way to work out the issue, either by, you know, finding a technical solution to it, or also sometimes just, you know, adjusting the scope of the game. But you keep that in mind and then you realize that there are very few issues that are actually unsolvable, and when you work with Unreal, you have access, you know, to the forums with some expert from Epic that can help you quite a lot. So I didn't know it existed before we got into actually creating the studio, but I think it was like our lifeline quite a few times. And I mean, even when we were, you know, a nobody studio, like we hadn't released anything yet, but yes, you could, you know, create a topic on that private forum with and you would have the people that actually implemented that engine feature, you know, discuss with you on how to investigate, or oh yes, this is something we have fixed internally, you can try this change
in your... like grab this patch from our
exactly. Wow. So in the end it's much less worse and daunting than it looks at first glance. So I would just give myself my former self the advice of not panicking too much and it's gonna be all fine.
Nice. And then related to that is, if you have a piece of advice for people that are just starting the journey that you've been on, so they're just starting their own studio with just a few people, or maybe they're just looking into getting funding or putting together their vertical slice or that demo, what kind of recommendations or tips would you give to them?
I mean, there are many, you know, different, you know, topics involving of you know, getting like a project to take off.
And if they're in your role, if like they're kind of more the developer type, a little more technical on a team,
I would say listen to the designers, because like ultimately technology is at, you know, the service of delivering you know, the best game possible. And the best game is, you know, it's narrative, it's music, it's cinematic, it's art. The gameplay, of course, is really important, but it's more up to the designers to, you know, to create all the amazing content that that we have in Expedition Series 3. And the programming team, we are here to allow that to exist and allow the designers to, yeah, be creative with tools that are, you know, not too much of a pain to use. And it's really been our mindset, like, throughout the full production. And I mean, it was true when we started at the very beginning, when it was just like Guillaume, and he was like pinging me from time to time to help with a new feature in the project. Up until now, where we have like a full team of programmers, we have a full team of designers. But still, it's important to consider, you know, not only the UX of the game for the players, but the UX of, as programmers, the tools you provide to the development team, because yeah, they are the one creating right. all the content for the game. I mean, that's the way we have, you know, structured it.
I love that even for a fairly small studio, having some internal tooling is important, of like putting stuff into the engine yourself to make it easier for your level designers or your artists, things like that. Do you have any like quick examples of something in that realm that was like a big, oh, this made all the designers so happy?
I think maybe the best technical decision we made, like on Expedition Series 3, was to use the sequencer for the skills. So all the skills, basically in Expedition Series 3, they are like small cinematics, because it's turn-based, it's very linear content. So it's a linear editing tool, which is native in Unreal, so we didn't even have to develop it.
Right, you didn't have to write too much.
Yeah, so exactly, sure. But yeah, just integrating that, you know, neatly with the battle system to have, you know, just the camera blending smoothly from a gameplay control camera to that linear, those linear sequences, that allowed the designers and Guillaume, the game director, to be super expressive, because you can literally synchronize anything in that. You have VFX, you have animation, you have sound, you can have slow motion, you can control all of that with a super convenient tool. And we could have, you know, done similar things with much more, you know, scripting, or okay, you have to trigger all the animations
more programmatically.
More programmatically, because like people in the team that are quite, you know, technical, like the designers, they can really do, you know, a lot of blueprints graph, like they are almost programmers in a way. But having this super expressive tool in the middle for everything that is related to the general, you know, direction, like movie direction almost of the game, I think it was the best choice we made. And it's okay that it's not a tool that we had to develop ourselves.
I think it's just
finding the right tool for the right problem. And in that case, that's what worked best for us.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much. I'm going to skip ahead to the thank you slide. Thanks you so much, Tom, for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And thank you to all of you for joining us.
If you enjoy this kind of in-depth conversation with leaders in the media, gaming, and visualization world, be sure to subscribe so that you get new episodes as soon as they come out. Subscribing and giving a review or rating is the only way that we know you enjoy this content so that we can keep making more of it. Reach out to me via email or LinkedIn with feedback, guest suggestions, or to connect if you'd like to be a guest yourself. I'm always looking for great stories, and I love learning about the many ways that game and real-time technologies are being used today. Links for that are in the episode description. Be sure to check out perforce.com for information about our full P4 platform based on the industry standard Perforce P4 version control. Special thanks to our production team, Ella Reiswig, Emily Matlack, Kaylee Torres, Luisa Pujala, and Chris Perez. I'm Jace Lindgren, and I will see you next time on In Development.